Welcome to New World Notes, hosted by Kenneth Doust. This week and next, Adam Curtis's new film, Bitter Lake. It's about Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan, and about why the best move the U.S. and Britain could make in Afghanistan is to get the heck out. I hope you'll stay tuned. Adam Curtis, the British documentary filmmaker, has a new movie just out. This one focuses on two hotspot countries of the Near East, countries whose recent history is closely connected. The two countries are Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan. One of the connections is Saudi Arabia's reactionary and militant form of Islam known as Wahhabism. The United States continues to keep its pledge to support and defend Saudi Wahhabism in exchange for oil. Despite what Saudi Wahhabism did to the World Trade Center on 9/11/2001. Or so Adam Curtis argues. Being Adam Curtis, he connects these themes with a whole lot of other ills plaguing the West. For instance, politicians who don't believe in governing. They've basically handed over the governing power to the big banks. The banks have used this power mainly to enrich themselves and to increase their own power further. And they've gotten fatter still on Saudi Arabian petrodollars. And the film is about blowback, about disastrous consequences that nobody had considered as they were preparing the ground for them. Typical Adam Curtis. And if Curtis once again bites off more than he can chew, or maybe chews a bit more than he can digest. Anyway, the results are still very interesting indeed. And the modern history of Saudi Arabia and Afghanistan is fascinating. And it helps show that the only sensible course of action for any country trying to rebuild Afghanistan in its own image, let alone trying to invade and conquer the country, the only sane course of action is to get the heck out before Afghanistan destroys you. The British learned this the hard way in the 19th century. The Russians learned this the hard way in the 1980s. The American government has no intention of learning anything from anyone else or even from experience. So the U.S.-led NATO invasion and occupation of Afghanistan is working about as well as everyone else's ever worked. Bitter Lake is the name of the film. That's probably the lake created by a massive American-led dam project in Helmand Province in the 1950s. That project was designed to turn Afghanistan into a modern, prosperous, Western-style democracy. Failed again. Bitter Lake also refers to the Russian science fiction film Solaris, that had a lake that destroyed the minds of everyone who got near it. A nice metaphor for the region. The film is about 2.25 hours long, so we won't hear it all. But this week and next, at least, we'll hear a good part of the first half of it, and probably more later. Skillfully adapted to radio by yours truly, here is Adam Curtis's Bitter Lake.
Increasingly, we live in a world where nothing makes any sense. Events come and go like waves of a fever, leaving us confused and uncertain. Those in power tell stories to help us make sense of the complexity of reality. But those stories are increasingly unconvincing and hollow.
Excuse me, I'm lying.
This is a film about why those stories have stopped making sense, and how that led us in the West to become a dangerous and destructive force in the world. It is told through the prism of a country at the center of the world, Afghanistan. In 1946, American engineers, along with their wives and families, began to arrive at a dusty airstrip in Helmand in southern Afghanistan. They worked for the biggest construction company in the world, called Morrison Knudsen. And the King of Afghanistan had brought them there to build a giant planned new world. A complex of dams, canals, roads, and even a new model city. The king's aim was to harness the power of the giant Helmand River and turn his country into a modern society, just like in the West.
The Asiatic Kingdom of Afghanistan is located roughly 10,000 miles from either coastline of the United States, almost directly on the opposite side of the globe, westward from China, beyond the Himalayas. It is a landlocked country, bordered on the north by the Soviet Union, and on the east by Pakistan, and on the west by Iran.
The king was called Zahir Shah, and he often came to visit the project. Afghanistan was a deeply conservative country, and he was determined to modernize it. What the king was trying to create in Helmand was a copy of what President Roosevelt had done in America in the 1930s. And the company he had hired, Morrison Knudsen, had worked back then for Roosevelt, building a new world of dams and power stations across America. Now they were going to do the same for Afghanistan. The engineers and their families lived in a complex of houses around the king's country palace in Helmand. It became known as Little America. At the end of the Second World War, President Roosevelt travelled to the Great Bitter Lake in the middle of the Suez Canal. At the same time, he sent another American warship to pick up the King of Saudi Arabia, King Abdulaziz. The meeting of King and President was to have powerful and disastrous consequences, both for the West and, in a strange way, for Afghanistan. Roosevelt was dying, but over the last 13 years, he had used his power on an epic scale to transform the world. After the Wall Street crash and the terrible depression that followed, Roosevelt had taken charge. He had passed laws that broke up the banks, so they would never run out of control again. And he had rebuilt America with a series of giant dams that brought electrical power and employment to millions of people. And he had planned and fought a world war against Germany and Japan. Now, as Roosevelt sat waiting for Abdulaziz, no one could possibly have imagined the consequences of this meeting. For it was going to unleash forces that in the future would undermine everything that Roosevelt had worked for. His belief that politicians should use their power in a planned way to reshape the world. But Roosevelt knew that to keep that power, America needed oil. And he wanted to forge an alliance with the king to make sure that the vast Saudi oil fields remained under American control. In their conversation, the two men laid the foundations for an alliance that continues to the present day. America would get its oil, and in return, Saudi Arabia would receive wealth and security from America. But the king was well aware of the dangers of opening up his country to the influence of the modern West. And in the negotiations that followed, he laid down a condition. "We will take your technology and your money," he said, "but you must leave our faith alone." The Saudi faith was called Wahhabism. It was a radical, violent, and extremely puritanical form of Islam. And its followers among the Bedouin tribes hated the modern world. Wahhabism was part of a wider movement in Islam that had risen up in reaction to the European empires. Another was the Deobandi movement in India. They all believed that modern imperialism was corrupting the true nature of Islam. and wanted to go back to a world based on the original teachings of the Islamic texts. Abdulaziz had harnessed this force in the 1920s to seize power. But he had unleashed something that didn't want to stop. The Wahhabists wanted to go on and create a caliphate across the whole of the Arab world. And to stop them, in 1929, Abdulaziz machine-gunned them. He ruthlessly killed the warriors who had made him king. But their belief, a violent, intolerant, and above all backward-looking version of Islam, remained at the heart of Saudi Arabian society. And the deal made that day on the Great Bitter Lake meant that America would get its oil, but it would also be protecting Wahhabism, a force that had its own global ambitions. Ambitions that were very different from America's.
A state funeral procession. Ahmad Shah Massoud had been the great hope for a future Afghanistan. But he had been killed by Osama bin Laden in 2001.
By the mid-1950s, the American engineers had built the giant dams that were going to create what they called a new wonderland of vegetation and power in Helmand. But the project was running into problems, and it was beginning to lose its innocence. As the giant dams were completed, they had an unexpected effect. They raised the level of the water table and started to bring salt to the surface. And one of the plants that thrived in this new soil were poppies. Some of those leading the project said they should stop. But the American government stepped in and insisted that they should continue. Because by now, the dams had become a central part of the struggle with the Soviet Union. All sides in the Cold War began to compete to offer Afghanistan bigger and better schemes to modernize the country. Afghan politicians exploited this ruthlessly. The Prime Minister, Mohammed Daoud, spent his time traveling the world, playing the countries, Russia, America and China, off against each other. Daoud wanted to use the modernization as a way of consolidating his power. Afghanistan was a fragmented country. Power was divided between ethnic groups and tribes. Daoud was a Pashtun, and he saw how the dam project in Helmand could be used to consolidate the Pashtun grip on the whole country. He persuaded the Americans to make the project even bigger, to turn it into a giant piece of social engineering. Thousands of Pashtun nomads, who spent their time roaming the border area with Pakistan, would be settled in the new farmland created by the dams. Daoud presented it as just another innocent piece of modernization, and the Americans happily agreed. What they didn't realize was that they were unwittingly being sucked into Afghan power politics. Not only was Daoud increasing Pashtun power, but he was sowing the seeds of bitter rivalries over the division and ownership of land in Helmand. In 1964, King Faisal became the new leader of Saudi Arabia. Faisal set out to modernize the country. He created Western-style bureaucracies and a welfare system. He even allowed television for the first time. But he faced two threats. One was from the religious leaders inside Saudi Arabia. They were the Wahhabists, who had brought his family to power and gave his rule legitimacy. They distrusted any idea of modernizing Saudi society. Faisal was also facing a dangerous situation abroad, from communism that was spreading through the Arab world. His solution was simple. Faisal decided to use the religious leaders and their conservative beliefs as a force to counter the international threat of communism. but he knew that this would also divert their attention away from his domestic policies. Faisal used the growing oil money to set up hundreds of schools and institutes across the Islamic world, some as far away as Pakistan. Their job was to spread Wahhabist ideas and help to turn Islam into a unified international force strong enough to stand up to communism. What Faisal was doing was taking the dangerous and unstable fanaticism at the heart of Saudi society and directing it outwards, beyond its borders. It was a ruthless way of creating stability in his own country. America gave this tacit approval because it was part of the global struggle against communism. But in 1966, Faisal gave America a glimpse of how uncontrollable an ally Saudi Arabia could be. He went to New York and publicly attacked America's support for Israel. It caused an outrage.
Angela and I wanted the dogs to look their very best because we were taking them out on a special assignment. We were all going off to the Mall, and we had to be there by 12 o'clock.
Come on then, dogs.
We felt very proud of Kingsley and Cleo because they'd been invited to join a guard of honour. Afghan Huns were going to salute their king because for the first time ever, the King of Afghanistan was coming to London. About 20 members of the Southern Afghan Hound Society had brought their dogs along to line the route, and there were Afghans of all colours and sizes. And when the Queen pointed us out, the King of Afghanistan seemed delighted to see us. For the first time in their lives, British Afghan Hounds were seeing people from their own country, because in the carriages that followed the Queen, there were more people from the Royal Court of Afghanistan.
But the ordered world, where kings and queens ruled and dogs behaved obediently, was about to collapse. In 1971, the King of Afghanistan had come on his first ever state visit to Britain. But it was also his last, because his ambitious Prime Minister, Mohammed Daoud, was already plotting against him. And in 1973, Daoud took power in a coup. He declared Afghanistan a republic and sent the king into exile. Two months later, Egypt attacked Israel, and a Middle East war started. To begin with, it looked as though Israel would be defeated. But the American government came to its rescue, airlifting arms on a massive scale to prevent the Israelis from being overwhelmed. The Israelis counterattacked, and the Arabs faced a disaster. But then Saudi Arabia came to the rescue, because King Faisal realized that his country had a weapon that could stop Israel. Overnight, Faisal raised the price of oil 5 times and threatened a complete embargo unless America forced Israel to pull back. It worked. A ceasefire was agreed. And everyone realized that the balance of power in the world had suddenly changed.
Saudi oil minister Sheikh Zaki Yamani.
What we want is the complete withdrawal of the Israeli forces from the occupied Arab territories. And then you'll have the oil at the same level of September 73.
Is this demand absolute and rigid, or is this just a negotiating position?
Definitely. We won't give up any inch of these lands.
Doesn't this new massive increase in the price of oil mean a change in the world balance of power between the developing nations like you, the producers, and us, the developed industrialized nations?
Yes, it will.
And what do you think arises from that?
Well, a new type of relationship. You have to adjust yourself to the new circumstances. And I think you have to sit down and talk seriously with us about this new era.
When Saudi Arabia raised the price of oil, they did it to change the political balance of power in the world. But it also had another unexpected effect, because it allowed the men who ran the banks and the financial system in America and Britain to begin to break free of political control. Billions of dollars flooded from the West into Saudi Arabia, most of which the Saudis didn't know what to do with. So they gave them to the Western banks to invest. The banks then made a crucial decision. They kept many of those dollars free from control by the American government. And they became a vast pool of wealth, known as petrodollars, that could be lent and traded anywhere around the world without political control. As Western politicians struggled to deal with the economic and social chaos that had been created by the oil price rise, their bankers were building a new global financial system based on recycling the Saudi billions. And the banks began to become rich and powerful again. As Western countries collapsed economically in the 1970s, students from Europe and America fled from the chaos. They came to Afghanistan as a land of dreams, a different, innocent world, free of the corruption of politics and money in the West.
A traveller is someone who proceeds through a country under his own initiative, with a certain internal drive to learn, to find out something more than the superficial. To me, an Afghan was some figure from a woodblock print in a book about India. The reality of an Afghan was so beyond that, their strength of character, which comes through in their most simple action.
But Afghan students still believe in the idea of revolution. Back in the 1960s, many students from Kabul University had been sent to universities in America. It had been part of the modernization project, and they brought back with them radical ideas from the American student left. Back in Kabul, those ideas then got mixed up with other left-wing theories that the Afghan students found in badly translated Russian books about Marxism. And in 1978, they decided to have a revolution. One of the leaders was Hafizullah Amin, and after the revolution, he ordered a film to be made about the role he had played. Amin also starred in the film, playing himself. It shows policemen coming to Amin's house to arrest him. He tries to hide some secret papers. But the policemen take him to jail, leaving his wife and daughter. Amin is then shown directing the revolution from his prison cell, and then riding on a tank to the president's palace.
Tanks loyal to young communist army officers now guard the palace where President Daoud ruled. Inside, he and his family, including his young grandchildren, were shot dead when his palace guard lost their courageous battle to defend him. Men from the different tribes who live in this backward country swarm all over tanks knocked out in the battle. They seem pleased to see the end of the old feudal regime.
The revolutionaries gave a press conference. Amin, it was announced, would become foreign minister. And the president of the Revolutionary Council was another ex-student, Mohammed Taraki.
Our relationship with all the countries, including Soviet Union, and all our neighbors and throughout the world will be based depend on the amount of their support to our revolutionary government in political, economical field.
Does this mean, Mr. President, that you will be following the strict policy of non-alignment?
This is quite correct.
The aim of the revolution was to create a new Afghanistan, and parades were held in Kabul to celebrate the radical vision. One of the main aims was to redistribute land fairly, to get rid of a feudal system of landowners and peasants. Every farmer was to be allowed to own their own land, and young revolutionaries from Kabul were filmed going out into the countryside to measure out the new plots. followed by the grateful farmers, kissing their new land certificates. But in reality, the land reforms set the seeds for a bitter conflict in Helmand. It made the divisions that had begun with President Dowd's reforms in the 1960s much worse. As the land was parcelled out, families accused each other of stealing the best bits. And all sorts of hatreds and rivalries were born in Afghan rural society. Rivalries that would set village against village, tribe against tribe. And in Kabul, the revolutionaries started to hate each other too. Hafizullah Amin decided that he should be in charge, and he arranged for his rival Taraki to be killed. Taraki was smothered with a cushion. Amin ordered that anyone who opposed the reforms should be thrown in jail or killed. In Helmand, 100 political prisoners were taken up in a plane and thrown into the giant lake created by the American dam. The Soviet leaders in Moscow became terrified that Afghanistan was falling apart, and they decided to intervene. They rang Amin to tell him that they were sending Russian troops to help his revolution. And at the end of 1979, the troops began to arrive at Kabul airport. What the Russians didn't tell Amin was that the troops were also coming to kill him. The Russians put a sniper on one of the main roads in Kabul, but Amin's convoy drove too fast and the sniper missed. They tried again. This time they put poison in Amin's can of Pepsi in the presidential palace. But his nephew drank it instead and died. Amin gave a banquet in a palace outside Kabul. The Soviets smuggled in a chef who poisoned the food. This time it worked. All the guests and Amin fell on the floor, writhing in agony. But the Afghan servants rang for help, and two Russian doctors turned up, who knew nothing of the plot. They pumped Amin's stomach, and he revived. So the Russian troops attacked the palace, threw a grenade at Amin, and shot him.
Here the video leaps forwards a few decades to our own time. It shows a riot in Afghanistan. People ransacking what looks like some public buildings. The Americans touched off this riot when they accidentally bombed an Afghan village. Here we must pause Adam Curtis's new documentary, Bitter Lake. More coming next week. And thank you for listening to New World Notes. Find our archive of past shows on the web at newworldnotes.blogspot.com. From Darkest Connecticut, this is Kenneth Doust. Illegitimi non carborundum. Keep the aspidistra flying, and ciao.